each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Welcome, everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds of Change. It's Wednesday, and it's my honor and privilege to share with Father Anthony Bush, this wonderful microphone. It's Wednesday. That means it's brain wrinkling time once again. Although I guess you could say brains are wrinkled almost any day of the week you tune into The Winds of Change. But let us say the wrinkling is more acute on Wednesdays here as I throw some many ideas at you, some common themes that I think are quite significant in our prayer life, our religious life, our church life, as it were. And I got a whole bunch of things in front of me here. Last week, I touched on a number of things. One of the things I touched on was the immigration issue, which is so much talked about, and it's very difficult to put your finger on it. And there's two very passionate sides. To be honest, the extreme, neither side that is very extreme, I'm very comfortable with. The send them all back kind of side is one side. Just doesn't seem like it's, number one, practical. Number two, really would be good for our economy. Number three, charitable, and number four, impractical, I guess, sort of like number three or number one, I guess. But also the open border side also seems very wrong, in the sense that it has a lack of understanding of the difficulties our country's facing vis-a-vis, especially, I'm going to put the weight of the difficulties not so much on the issue of limited resources. I think that gets the attention the most, limited resources. Now, in some cases, that may need to be done. Things need to be tweaked. But as the first reason against complete open borders, I don't think that rises to the first position. The necessity of a country like ours to have a respect for civil law is probably first and foremost. Because we are not held together by ethnic identities, which is what holds so many countries together. And that's a powerful glue, shall we say. You know, it's a powerful glue when you are bonded with others who share your ethnic heritage, your tribal bonds, as it were. And in some sense, it's like, well, we're all related. Biologically, by blood, in a certain way, that's true. But the United States is different. in that regard, that our country would hold together by ethnic glue is illogical. Maybe we could say it that way. Because we pride ourselves that this nation was built by many different ethnic groups, vis-a-vis the vast amount of immigrants from around the world in different countries, that ethnic glue is inoperable here in the United States of America, right? Do you ever get some glue that doesn't work? Tape? Do you ever put some tape on something and it just falls off? That's a common problem sometimes around the household repairs. Of course, if you got duct tape. Oh, yeah.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
There we go. That's the first of many in this hour, I'm sure. But I'm a big believer in super glue, actually. Super glue and duct tape. I think you could probably fix most anything in a household with super glue and duct tape. Or super glue or Gorilla Glue. I don't know which one's better, but they're both very, very strong. But you know what it's like when you put glue that doesn't really belong to your project. You can put Elmer's glue on paper. You can put it on wood, I think, very, very. Plastic? I don't know. Depends on the nature of the plastic, I guess. But try putting two pieces of metal together with Elmer's glue, or two pieces of glass, for that matter, with just regular old Elmer's glue. What's going to happen? It ain't going to hold. It ain't going to hold. The nature of the steel is such that the nature of the regular Elmer's glue won't penetrate the surface, won't bond. It won't form a bond. You need something like super glue or Gorilla Glue to do that job. And so I'm saying that in terms of the immigration issue, that ethnic identity as a unifying factor in the United States just doesn't work. And since the vast majority of countries depend on that kind of bond, they just assume in some ways that it will work here, or if they don't know what else. Well, the what else, of course, is a sense of the rule of law and certain values that have been a part of 200 years of history of the United States. Here I shared a little bit of what I think needs to be added to the conversation, and I am going to play something here, and you're going to have to take a guess on why I picked this here song. Let's see if we can get it.
You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
There we go. Was it, should I give him, this is very good, Nick. Was it the Beatles? Was it Donny Osmond? Or was it The Doors? Well, you would be right if you picked the third answer. Okay, we can stop the air. Okay, so everyone phoned in, and it seems like the vast majority of the people are fine 60s and 70s music appreciation folks, and that indeed was The Doors singing, Come On Baby, Light My Fire. didn't remember how many songs they sang or anything. But the reason I share that with you is because I want to make this a very... I want to get a movement started. I always want to get movements started. I got many in my up my sleeve, but one of the ones is whenever the immigration issue is brought up, and especially the issue of a wall, I think we should quickly add a wall with doors, of course. A wall with doors. So when we say the wall and this kind of sense, the kind of spirit that it has is, for many, it's the walls that surround a prison, which are tall and high, usually have barbed wire on top of them, and have no doors, except maybe one where there's a guy with a machine gun standing in front of it. Also, the wall that separated East Germany, East Berlin from West Berlin, that was put up by the communists, also comes to mind, of course. And that, too, had a lot of barbed wire, and there was a famous door, the Brandenburg Gate, of course, but not many doors, and it was quite foreboding, as it were, trying to keep people from getting out. A wall between Mexico and the United States, I propose, should have lots of doors, which means what? It means you have to sort of knock. A door implies knocking and allowing entering. So what that means is there needs to be, for a national identity, a certain screening process. And it can be quite liberal. It can be quite basic. But it can't be nothing. And open borders certainly seems to indicate nothing. And that's why I want everybody to think of Come On Baby, Light My Fire when we think of the immigration issue, because it was sung by a group called The Doors. It's kind of I don't know much about that group, but they had a bunch of hits, I guess. They're not in the, they don't rise to the level of happy 60s songs that I often associate with the 60s, in the sense that they were in some ways part of the seeds of the moral, they planted the seeds of the moral breakdown, which eventually has grown into a garden of weeds that we live in today. There are a number of 60s and 70s songs that were much more wholesome, even in their themes of love, and because a lot of those themes had the themes you could divide, I think, 60 songs and 70 songs into themes that 90%, if not 99%, are about love, but you can divide those in between those that are promoting free love and those were promoting eternal love or unending love, you could sort of say. Anyways, that'll be, I'll have to analyze. I'll have to bring a whole bunch of those songs, and we'll work on that. But be mindful, wow, my friends, because that is what happens.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Indeed. And the brain should be wrinkled. So, anyways, I want to segue in the issue of the wall with doors. Could segue into another issue that is involved in our church today, and that is the issue of how do we pastorally deal with the marriage situations which are not sacramental, not blessed by the church, that, of course, includes people of same-sex attraction that are now legally married. That includes those who are not married yet. That includes those who were married, divorced, and remarried again without obtaining an annulment. Should I throw in there that I was going to be so bold as to say that some of the problems and sins of clergy, of priests and sisters, I guess you could say, that are held to different vows and are breaking those vows, that's it's a sin that needs repentance as well, you know? The idea that these relationships can be recognized as no problem. Well, I don't think anybody wants to say that there's no problem, but that these people in these kinds of relationships are equally worthy or equally prepared. Let's say it that way, because no one's really worthy to receive Holy Communion, but equally prepared to receive Holy Communion. That's where we get into a difficulty, and that's where there is a rather large debate going on within the church today. So we need to analyze this and discuss it. Where is the Lord calling us? What are we to think about all these things? Let me share with you a writer who is taking a position that the old-fashioned discipline that has been in the Catholic Church for so many years, if not 2,000 years, namely that when someone is conscientious of a grave mortal sin, that they are to refrain from receiving the host in the Holy Communion. A writer from Rome, actually, this is from an article by Edward Penton of the National Catholic Register, but Penton is describing the position of Professor Gerhard Hoover. Professor Hoover. The point that Gerhard Hoover is making, which I think truly needs a strong bit of attention, because he's saying something very new, very different. Yes, you can use the word radical. And the radicalness of it needs to be appreciated in a much deeper way than I think it is. What he's saying is Professor Hoover, in a reflection on Pope Francis's words, is saying that this document, this apostolic letter, is bringing out a new theological sense that the term intrinsically evil is outdated. Okay, in the sense that here is an act that is always wrong. We have to change our understanding. We have to change one of these moral principles, namely that some acts have a characteristic which we have heretofore always been calling intrinsically evil, intrinsically wrong, the kind of circumstance that surrounds it doesn't make it right. Now, let me say right here at the outset, my friends, something that I think can help us swallow this situation, this attack on a classical principle, and if those who are attacking this classical principle would understand other classical moral principles, I do believe they would surrender, in some sense, their pastoral plan, as it were. What do I mean by that? It is true that our Catholic moral thinking has always held to this idea that some acts are intrinsically wrong, intrinsically evil, bad. Although the term evil, I think, is what gets a lot of people. When you think of evil, you think of a mass murderer or Hitler or Osama bin Laden blowing up terrorist attacks and what have you. You don't think of a person being unfaithful as an evil person. And in that sense, I don't think... I want to hold back from saying that everyone who does commit an act of unfaithfulness is an evil person. But that being said, I say that because I believe in some other principles besides the intrinsically intrinsically evil character of an act. What's the other principle that I believe in? I love the doctrine of the Trinity, because just the basic understanding that you don't grasp all of God unless you grasp His nature as a Trinity. Without getting too much into the nature of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, if we just appreciate how oftentimes three aspects shine light on one thing, shall we say, that's the genius of the phenomenological approach to philosophy these days. That's the theological issue of the Trinity spills over into political and moral philosophy, where you need more than just one truth that you're holding on to. Okay, so I'm holding up this truth that some human acts are intrinsically morally evil. But there's another truth that says many times circumstances do mitigate one's culpability. Okay? Can you swallow that? many times circumstances do mitigate Okay.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, I hope I did. And if you understood all the, I gotta unpack those words because I use some fancy words there, right? The circumstances can, and they often do, mitigate the culpability of the person. And there's two words in this second moral principle that are very important. One is culpability. The other is person. Mitigate, I assume you kind of know what that means. It lessens. It lessens the guilt factor, as it were. Is someone still guilty? I think you can easily say yes. If it's someone else, you're quick to say yes. Even if it's yourself, your guilt is mitigated. That's almost all the time that whenever we do something wrong, we always have a good reason, and that good reason we feel justifies our doing something wrong. But even when we recognize and we wake up and we say, "Oh, I did wrong," that sliding sense of guilt should exist. It certainly can be smaller or larger, though oftentimes the better a person is, the holier a person is, the greater guilt they feel, even with small infractions, shall we say. Okay, are you following me? So that's the attack by Professor Hoover, attack against the traditional teaching of intrinsically moral evil. I think he needs to appreciate what we call moral determinants. I think he's ignorant about what has classically been understood as moral determinants. What do we mean by that is that a person's moral character is determined by not just one thing, but one of those things has to be the good or badness of the act itself. Classical, and what I mean by that is classical Catholic moral theology basically says that the act itself could be good or bad. Number two, there's the circumstances that could elevate or diminish the culpability of the person's deservedness of praise or deservedness of blame. Obviously, if there's an evil, objectively evil act, then we're talking about a blame. and certainly some people do deserve great blame, and some people would warrant less blame, but blame somewhere nonetheless. And then the third moral determinant is the motivation. So you got the act itself, you got the circumstance, you got the motivation. These things have to be all considered. And the classical evaluation, the classical line of thought is that if any one of these three indicate badness, then you shouldn't do the act. Though, as I say, circumstance might mitigate the culpability, the praiseworthiness or blameworthiness of the person who did the act. But see, what's at stake and what's so dangerous about this Professor Hoover is if he removes the intrinsically evil part of our equation, then you only have two other moral determinants. You only have the circumstances and the intention, and the act itself sort of disappears. And that is a tremendously great danger. And I those who are promoting this line of thinking are woefully ignorant of how important that third of the three, or it's the first, whatever it is, one of the three moral determinants really is. Take that down. And that's why I say that the genius of the Trinity can come to our rescue in a sense that the beautiful mystery of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit shed some light on other aspects of our being in our life. So there's a couple other important quotes that I want to share with you from this Professor Hoover. And then I got to share with you some of the very good insights of Bishop Tom Papraki, who gets this and is trying to promote this. But I'm afraid he's a voice crying in the wilderness in some sense. So let's take a quick break here now and stay tuned. I'm Father Tom Coy, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to Listener Supported, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the divine mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the Rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass. Also, at 5:30, a Spanish Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, Adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
We at Winds of Change thank you for your prayers and financial support. As you have often heard, Winds of Change is listener supported. That means you, and especially now. Please give what you can to help support Winds of Change to stay on the air. Any amount will be greatly appreciated. Simply go to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And click on the radio button to make your donation to Winds of Change, which will be a tremendous blessing. Thank you.
I'm Father Thomas Loya, inviting you to be drawn to Christ's passion through the wonderful performance of the Seven Last Words of Christ, 7 p.m. Friday, March 23rd, at St. Mary Church, 19515 115th Avenue, Mokena, Illinois.
The Last Seven Words of Christ is both a theatrical and musical portrayal of the Passion of Christ. Unlike any other production, the actors never speak a word. The narration and dialogue of the scenes are given by the 50-member choir, soloists, and live orchestra through the musical work of composer Theodore Dubois and others. Simonetta Pasek, director, Anna Pasek, conductor. Purchase tickets at St. Mary's after all masses or the parish office or online at danceintegro.com. DanceIntegro.com. And click on shows. The Last Seven Words of Christ, Friday, March 23rd, 7 p.m. at St. Mary Parish, 19515 115th Avenue, Mokena, Illinois.
Hey, welcome everyone. Gee, that last little promo there for the Seven Last Words of Christ, I got to add my kudos and encouragement to get out there. If I didn't have Mass in the evening, I would be there. I'm sure it'll be a moving and powerful way to segue into the Holy Week, right? And God bless Sir Mineta and Mrs. Jenna Podziewinski is involved in that with some of the music. I gotta say this before I get back to my heavy, deep, and real brain wrinkling here. But if you haven't heard of a new little high school that was started, we had saw Mrs. Podziewinski at a banquet for Chesterton Academy of the Holy Family. It's a small little. I don't know. It's a miracle going on right in the midst of our world here today. It's a small little Catholic high school. It has only about 50 or 60 students. It's just in its second year, started by Dale Ahlquist, the first Chesterton Academy was founded by Dale Ahlquist. Many of you might know Dale Ahlquist through EWTN and his wonderful series on G.K. Chesterton. He plays Chesterton and brings him to life very, very beautifully. Dale started a school curriculum for high school students because he felt and he saw that our Catholic schools were not turning out good, strong Catholics, you know. And I for one, have to say I agree with that. Whatever good things they're doing, what they do, they're doing well. But what they're not doing well, what they're not doing is strengthening and planting the kind of faith in teenagers which will carry them through into their adulthood. Should I say this? Yeah, I'll say it because I was a young adult once, and I think if you are an adult now, chances are you remember when you were a young adult, or do I dare say a teenager? But obviously one of the major issues in that stage of life, shall we say, is the issue of hormones and relationships with people of the other opposite sex, right? If you're a boy, things happen with girls and girls with boys, etc. If we neglect that aspect and how key the issues of chastity and the right view of marriage are, and how the sacramental view of marriage is attacked, maligned, ignored, belittled. Can I think of anything else? All those incredible adjectives there. Anyways, if we're not really concentrating, if we don't really make a concerted effort to help our kids know that these things are real and will need to be in their hearts and in their minds. Doesn't mean, of course, they won't trip and fall. It doesn't mean they won't sin. But by George, when we sin, we have to know we're sinning. And we're in a new age when we sin, we don't think we're sinning. that's a very dangerous thing. But anyways, G.K. Chesterton Academy of the Holy Family, started by Dr. Tierney and his wife, they and Briney Bowles and his wife, these two couples are really beautiful, and they're going to experience a tremendous amount of challenges. I pray for them, they got a good model going, and pray that they can be successful. I toast as well two other little grade schools that are out in our southwest corner of the world, Everest Academy and Kingswood Academy. They are two Catholic schools that were started started not by diocesan officials, but by parents, along with different church branches, shall we say. The Everest Academy has strong ties with the Legionaries of Christ and the Regnum Christi consecrated women, and Kingswood Academy had, and they still do have somewhat, the spiritual guidance and inspirations from priests of the Opus Dei. So kudos to these organizations that are trying their best, as it were. And even with the best of intentions, even with the best of people, the devil will definitely try to dismantle and ruin those endeavors, as it were. So anyways, had to throw that in. But let's get back to this article by Professor Gerhard Hoover, who is taking on, he's trying to explain why what I call the more progressive liberal interpretation of Pope Francis's apostolic letter, Moris Laetitia, and the change of the policy of receiving communion vis-a-vis your status, vis-a-vis your marriage in life. And so he's singling out an aspect of traditional Catholic moral thinking and saying it's outdated. That is the concept that we can call, that there is something called intrinsically evil acts, that we can describe an act that has an intrinsically evil character. And lo and behold, I was very surprised to see this angle coming at him, because it's the theme that has drawn my attention. I think I've brought this up in previous shows, and that being Peter Kreft's describing and trying to help us understand what heaven is like. And one of the deep, beautiful insights, as far as I'm concerned, is Peter Kreft's meditation and teachings on what time and space have in heaven versus on earth. The reason I say that is because I got to read to you what Professor Hoover wrote. I'd love to have a call-in show here now, because I need it to be unpacked. He seems to think he's saying something very profound. Anyways, here we go. He says this. This is a little quote, that the hypothesizing on the moral theology of Amoris Laetitia, the principle that time is greater than space mentioned in in the apostolic exhortation Evangelium Gaudium, another apostolic letter of Pope Francis, the joy of the gospel. So in the joy of the gospel, Pope Francis uses this term, time is greater than space. And so Professor Hoover wants to use that insight in order to dismantle the idea that some acts are intrinsically evil. So he says, time and space have an effect on specific theologies, such as the theological view of marriage and the family. All right? I got to stop there, and I wish I could call him up and say, what are you talking about there?
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
No, I actually, my brain was just fried, because when you're trying to think of something that you don't get, your brain is not wrinkled, your brain is fried. but we don't have a clip for that, but I'll look for one somewhere along the line. But anyways, I got to repeat this again. Try to follow here, because I think I can help this debate. I think I can help avoid a disaster, as it were. He's saying time and space, the principle that time is greater than space, has an effect on the specific theologies, has an effect on specific theologies. I think he wants that word specific to be important, in the sense that, well, there's lots of different theologies, in the sense that there are different denominations. See, I think that's what he's operating under. Obviously, we know and we recognize there are different denominations. I mean, we respect people's different denominations. Of course we do. But when we say there's different theologies, are we saying there can two contradictory statements both be true? And be careful, my friends. Be very careful. So when you hear the word contradictory, please, please, please. Did I say please? Please don't confuse it with contrary. Contrary and contradictory are very different words. They sound a lot alike, but unless you have a good appreciation of the difference between, a contrary could be something like this. I love pizza. My wife loves Subway sandwiches. of course, I don't have a wife, but I was just putting that in the generic we, okay? That's a contrary, two different contrary thoughts or values or tastes. A contradictory, an example of a contradiction would be this. Joe loves pizza. Joe does not love pizza. See that? You know, that's a contradiction. And we got to keep that in mind, because we're going to come back. We got to analyze this strange sense. And I think Peter Kreft and his meditations on heaven vis-a-vis time and space. I want Hoover to listen, read, or appreciate what Peter Kreft is saying, is trying to teach, because I think he's woefully missing the boat. Anyways, let's take a quick break right here. I'm Father Tom Kois. This is listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
We at Winds of Change thank you for your prayers and financial support. As you have often heard, Winds of Change is listener-supported. That means you, and especially now. Please give what you can to help support Winds of Change to stay on the air. Any amount will be greatly appreciated. Simply go to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And click on the radio button to make your donation to Winds of Change, which will be a tremendous blessing. Thank you.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule? Work? Or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm really in deep theological waters here, so I hope you're not operating any heavy machinery or what have you. You know, I don't have Tony here, and I haven't been able to give that warning, you know. Oh, and speaking of Tony, Speaking of Tony, please offer a prayer for his mother-in-law who's ailing and needs our prayers. All of you listeners of Winds of Change, I'm sure no one... appreciate and love good old Tony, who adds that great color, which I miss oftentimes when I'm here solo, flying solo, as it were. Not Han Solo, but solo nonetheless. Anyways, I'm trying to help avoid a catastrophe in our church by trying to help recover the sense of our traditional Catholic teaching with something that is afoot today, and that is an admittedly, of course, pastoral sense of trying to help people in irregular marital situations, and that opens the door to many different kinds, but especially gay marriages and people that are remarried, divorced and remarried without an annulment. And you could throw in other classic examples too, but those two rise to the top. But Professor Hoover, who is trying to explain why the idea of an intrinsically moral act is outdated, and we got to just throw that concept away. I'm trying to explain why it is an essential part of a tripod of moral determinants, okay? Try to remember that phrase, moral determinants, because there's three classic moral determinants: the act itself, the motivation, and the circumstances. All those three are very important. But you get one wrong and you can't have a virtuous, good act. You may be, in a sense, forced to do it, but that you're never... You'd be forced by circumstances, you'll say, but and this is where I often throw in the very Catholic and very traditional and very important reality called martyrdom. Martyrs are those who are willing to not take an option that will allow them to go on. I cannot do what you're asking me to do. I will not, I can't stop doing what you're asking me to stop doing, one way or the other. I will accept martyrdom. Do it for me what you will. Do it whatever you want. But I'm not going to do that. That's a sense that those people have of the very importance of the intrinsically evil act. In the early days of the church, you would say, oh, that was primarily about putting incense into a bucket of coal that stands before a false god. And you'd sort of be right. That would certainly be the liturgical expression that many led those early Christians to the lions. However, you can't separate that little liturgical act, the act of offering incense to a false god, especially if the false god is the emperor. But you can't separate that from the moral framework of people's lives in those days, especially about marriage. And so it has been and always will be a central part of what we believe, because marriage is such a reflection of God. Marriage is such a reflection of God, because it has that that divine mirror, husband and wife giving life to children. It has that Trinitarian reflection. It's not, of course, people are not God, but it reflects God. And it's the greatest, it's the most beautiful reflection of God. And that's why us Catholics do have a bunch of rules and ways about them, about marriages, and why so many people will dismiss them. They're not tuned into what it really means. And remember this, my friends, too. The debates over marriage, and shall we say the redefinition of marriage, needs to be connected to the definition of human sexuality. It's a redefinition of what sex means. I never tire of expressing the thought, and I've yet to be contradicted or proven wrong when I say, oh, two men can't have sex. They can't have that physical bond that is the essential part of marriage. And many times when I express that thought, people sort of laugh at me and chuckle and think, well, this guy doesn't know much about relationships. You know, of course two men have physical relations. And of course they do have physical relations, but they don't have human sex as God, as it is specially designed. So instead of thinking, are we redefining marriage, we're redefining the very definition of what sex is. So let's put that aside. But here, getting back to the more theoretical here, I got to see if I could wrap this up here, because as I said before, Peter Kreft, in his beautiful book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Heaven, leads us to meditate and appreciate time and space in a very different way. And I was just surprised to see that this professor, Gerhard Hover, is using something similar to justify the disappearance of an objectively moral act. Because he says here, the author of the article, where I'm bringing this from, Edwin Penton, describes Hoover by saying he believes that the principle, time is greater than space, relates to an interplay between the eternal and temporal spheres, taking on a moral theological significance that affects the previous teaching about intrinsically evil actions. Okay, let's stop there again and back it up. Time is greater than space relates to the interplay between the eternal and temporal spheres. Here's what I think Professor Hoover is trying to say. Time is greater than space. I think what he's trying to say is something similar to what we often say is time heals everything. You know what I mean? You could have something really bad happen to you, and while it's happening, and even a little bit afterwards, it really hurts, and you really are upset. You see, you feel something evil was done to you. You feel something bad happen. You feel someone did something bad to you. But over the course of time, time heals. So I think that's what he's saying. But time is greater than space. I think he means that. If you mean something different, I'd love to know. Because time is greater than space. If I had to translate that or bring it to another kind of a colloquial thought, it might be the passage of time is more important than your local motion. where you go. In other words, let's use let's keep the issue of a divorce at hand. Someone, they fall in love, they live together, they think they have a good marriage going, or maybe it's on the rocks from the get-go. And then they get divorced, and that hurts both the man and the woman. And we can say, okay, time will heal. And so perhaps perhaps after 10 years, 5 years, whatever, you move on and you you try to start a new life. And so that passage of time heals that wound. Whereas, if we're going to, I'm trying to give Professor Hoover the benefit of the doubt and trying to come up with some logical meaning to his theory, time is greater than space. You could say that time has a greater power in healing the wounds than moving. you know, if you get divorced and you move across the country, moving to a different state or a different city, of course, might heal you. It might. And indeed, sometimes that does help, right? You know, I've known many people who do that. And that's maybe part of why. But does either the time passing or the moving away from each other, proximity, does that change the goodness or badness of what happened? It's much more on a theological or psychological. It's more on a psychological level. Yes, I'm glad I gotten over that, as it were. But it doesn't change the fact that, ooh, she done me wrong or he did me wrong. That was wrong of what he did or what she did. And so enter Peter Kreft in a much different way of bringing in the time and space continuum, because Peter Kreft says, yes, we to appreciate time in this world, many wonderful things can come about. But part of being a wise person is knowing that time is a significant matter in life. Animals, I don't think about time, worry about time, or the passage of time doesn't happen. They don't have any recorded histories of the world of squirrels or anything like that. And so Peter Kreft wisely says, in heaven, God is outside of time. So we enter into the eternal presence of God when we get to heaven. And so it's true that time in this world is different than time in heaven, and space is different in this world than space is different in heaven. Please believe me that this little key insight could disarm the arguments of someone like Professor Hoover. God love you for listening, and keep the faith. I'm Father Tom Coase. You've been listening to Listener Supported, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now.